If you love the Godfather movies, then you'll love Take the Cannoli, the Godfather podcast. Each week, we take a few minutes to talk about anything and everything Godfather, including business and leadership lessons from the Godfather. Here's your consigliere, Lou Bortone.
Hey, it's Lou Bortone, host of Take the Cannoli, the Godfather podcast. And today we are doing something a little different and way more fun because I'm here with my friend Liz Scully, who is, I don't even know how to describe you because you're like a Renaissance woman. You do a lot of cool stuff.
Thank you very much.
The masterminding groups, evil coach, as you can see in your background there. I noticed, did you add the ravens recently?
I added them over Halloween, as one does, but a pack of crows and ravens.
Oh, that's cool. I have actual ones outside and they just stare me down out there and say, I'm going to kidnap your pug when you're not looking. But that's a nice touch. The ravens are a nice touch to that. And not uncoincidentally, if that's a word, you worked in Hollywood in the movie business for quite some time, as did I, although we're in far different disciplines. So tell folks what you did back in the day, as we like to say.
Back in the day. So I worked in visual effects. I worked in what we call post-production. So after you've shot the film, you then add all of the effects, which is what I did. And I worked in lighting. So on big Hollywood films, they shoot a lot of stuff against green screen, but that has to be filled in. And that was geeks. Geeks like me sat in massive rooms with other geeks creating it. And I was based in London, New York, weirdly, also in Bangalore, LA. Yeah. So basically, I've sat in dark rooms with sweaty boys all over the world.
Does it tend to be a male-dominated, or at least back then, industry?
It was changing while I was there, but yes, it's predominantly a male industry. And also, interestingly, it's also got a lot of brilliant people, but also very neurodiverse people. The point where maths, because obviously it's computing, maths and art meet is also where some of the more interesting neurodivergence happened. It was fascinating to be around people who were brilliant, but weren't necessarily good at things like eye contact.
Yeah, or talking.
Or women, actually, to be honest, being near people of a different gender to them, often difficult.
Although I have not been diagnosed, I swear I'm on like the Asperger's spectrum because I have trouble like making eye contact and I make everything awkward. And so I expect it was like, so I was perfect for Hollywood because
I used to run teams of lighting peeps, and I would walk in and go, okay, lads, this is how it's going to be. Yeah. I need you. I don't even need you to look at my eyes. I need you to pretend you're looking at my eye. You look just here between my the edge of my glasses, just here. Just like, I don't need you to look me in the eye. I just need you to pretend. This isn't for you. This is for me. And they're all like, all right, Liz.
You guys were in post-production, which is really cool. And the whole, like you say, the effects. Are there specific movies that you worked on or shows?
I did, although I'm very hesitant to talk about them because nothing dates like effects. So I worked on John Carter. I worked on some of the Madagascar films. Worked on a terrible, I shouldn't say that. I worked very hard on a series called Dinotopia that had this really beautiful three-verse kind of kickoff, hallmark, gorgeous thing, which is what I worked on. Then it had a really average series that ran for many series and episodes and just got worse and worse. And it wasn't the quality of the work. It was just they had smaller and smaller budgets. I worked on the good stuff. And that was lovely because I used to build cities. That's what I did. So if you wanted to extend your set and in Dinotopia, So in Dinotopia, you see this massive city and you see it at night and at daytime and in the rain and on fire and being attacked by giant dinosaurs. And we had to build it so that you could get it to do all of that and blow bits of it up. And it was called Waterfall City, which meant that big chunks of it were wet.
Oh my gosh.
Which, if you know anything about 3D effects, like wet things at the time, particularly back in the 90s, was hot.
Yeah, that's really cool. It's interesting because I think it's probably similar to what when I worked at E! Entertainment Television, you'd go into an editing bay and it was like NASA. It was like just screens everywhere. And oh my God, like I would just get hives just looking at the equipment. And now it's, I'll just edit it here.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. We often used to work so that they're writing the software as you're using it. That you'd often have a lighting technical director, which is what I was at first. And then you move up, so you're running teams. So they'd have a TD, a technical director, next to a coder. so that we'd work in twos. So you'd be working away and like suddenly things would stop working. Like, did you fix something?
I just haven't written that part of the code yet.
Exactly. Or you'd go out for lunch and everything would be fine. And when you came back, you're like, there was nothing to do with you. Yeah. It's like, I just changed it. Just change it back.
I know. We edited on Avid, which was just like this huge, ridiculous system. And that's the interesting thing. And maybe you can talk a little bit about how now it's like when you want to do effects on videos, you've got AI, you've got all kinds of stuff where you can basically snap your fingers and wait a minute, that used to take me 3 years or 3 months.
Yes, things have sped up. And also, that said, my level of awareness, because I spent 20 years looking at the edges of things, looking where matte lines, how things fit together. One of the things that upsets me a lot is, so the lovely background you have behind you, that works great. Yes, the Hollywood thing, because it's got a nice green screen around you. And it used to be really difficult. But if you put your background against my fluffy hair, it would look awful. Or do you often see people on Zoom where their shoulders come in and out, or their hand suddenly pops in? I find it, because of my years in film, I find it really hard to look at people when they're doing
it. I know.
What are you thinking?
It makes me crazy. And again, I have pretty good lighting and a decent green screen, but I used to have to edit people's videos where they'd just send me, okay, just do it on a green screen. And if they had hairs like yours, I'd be like, oh my God, it would take me hours to fix the green screen. And now you go on Zoom and just say, I want this background. Boom. So it's gotten a lot easier. Although, even with all the technology and how simple it's become, it still drives me crazy to see people disappear into the background because they have shitty lighting. Or even on CNN or NBC, on these networks, you've got a guy that, okay, we're going to bring in our guests. And he's like, all right, I'm coming in from Hollywood. Hello, people.
Yes, exactly.
I yell at the TV. I'm like, get a goddamn webcam that works.
Exactly. Actually, one of the most, you're a geek when. I remember sitting in the cinema and it was some science fiction film. I can't remember which one. But the spaceship arrives against the starscraft and it is so badly matted in. You could pretty much just see the map. And I was so surprised by it. I screamed. And my friend was like, what? And I'm like, I really am, truly. That's my nerd card actually given to me for the fact that I screamed at a matte line.
Yeah, I will watch the weather on local TV just to check out the green screen. I don't know. She's getting a lot of green bounce off her hair there.
Or on people's glasses. You often see a green cast. Like, oh, do it again.
Yeah, and people are like, what are you talking about? I'm like, you wouldn't understand.
Exactly. And that's really the point. Is it for me, one of my creative directors told me years ago, anything that pulls you out of the movie, pulls you out of the story, whether it's a series or a Zoom call, anything that makes you stop the connection with what's happening. So you're screaming at a matte line or a weatherman's shirt flash in and out. Do they not tell people not to wear the green? If you're green, don't wear a green shirt.
That's funny too, because if I'm shopping for, okay, I'm going to Las Vegas next week, I should get a good shirt. But I'm thinking like, oh, that won't work well on green screen. That's how I shop now.
Exactly. But anything that pulls you out of that, it's not good. So obviously we're sensitized to it. Most of the time, it's amazing. Because I remember I did a show for Jim Henson's, The Muppet People. Mm-hmm. I did a show for them called The Dr. Seuss Show. Ooh. Nobody will have seen it because nobody saw it at the time, let alone now. But it had a virtual set. And this was revolutionary. We had this massive team of tech people. My head of department spent most of probably about 8 months just screaming across at technical people because it went horribly wrong. Now, your picture on Zoom is doing effectively the same thing better. No processing and no difficulty
For free,
yes. Yeah.
So I know I have I have so many different virtual backgrounds. It's ridiculous, but you can put animation behind you and it'll look pretty good. You can do pretty much anything.
With your haircut, you're blessed in the green screen. Well, look at that. That is a thing.
I have a roaring fire in my fake living room. But you talk about the suspension of disbelief, because we always used to say the best editing is the editing that you don't notice. And that's what we used to say about movies. It's okay, you have to suspend your disbelief. And if you popped out of the thing, you've lost it. Anything that detracts from that magic is going to screw it up.
And for me, the best visual effects are not necessarily in things like The Galaxy or Thor. They're all wonderful and delightful. But for me, the effects that really impress me are when you don't know they're there. The Thompson film, the art film that's just suddenly removed an entire city so it looks like the 18th century. All of that stuff, when it's done well, you don't notice it.
Mm-hmm.
Heartbreaking for the people doing it, because it's great. There's 9 months of my life and nobody's noticed.
Yeah. So what about a movie business, obviously? And I talk about in the Godfather podcast, I talk about the making of The Godfather, which was a nightmare in and of itself. But that was like traditional Hollywood filmmaking, and they'd have to go and find the location and the right set. And there was no green screen and no effects. And then when we worked in the biz too long ago, but how has it changed just in terms of, okay, we have to make a TV show, go do it.
Speed of turnaround, I have to say. And this must have happened to you. But we used to get a lot of directors that would come in and go, so I saw this film at the weekend.
Oh, no.
Yes. You have the budget of a beer commercial. You're lucky.
Yeah.
And you want to make something that is the same as a 200 yes. million.
Yeah. I saw Avatar film this weekend and I was thinking.
Exactly. Yeah, I saw all of this amazing ice effect. And we would come in from having seen whatever the latest screening is.
Yeah.
And we're like, maybe we'd take bets. On, I bet someone comes in and wants that ice effect or exactly this massive blue planet. No.
Yeah. No. Oh my gosh. So were you, like, that's the thing. People think, oh my gosh, you're on the Warner Brothers lot and you must see all these stars. No, I'm in a room with a screen.
Exactly. And lighting, post-production lighting, which is what I did. It happens in the dark and actually see, we were like mushrooms.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's what we used to call it. You got to get your studio tan going in.
Exactly.
And then you worked in a lot of different, so you, it didn't matter whether you were in London or Los Angeles and you were doing the same thing.
We had no, like we would occasionally visit the windows, but we never saw actual daylight. I feel like I'm Irish, so I'm very pale the rest of the time, but I feel like the control subject in a, does tanning age you?
Yes.
Exactly. I didn't see daylight for 20 years.
Oh my God.
Oh, good.
Crazy. Yeah. So how did you get into that to begin with? It was a different business.
I worked really hard. Have you ever noticed that people will ask you questions like, not how did you get into it, but how did you end up in film?
I just fell on my lap.
Nobody just ends up in film. You have to work really hard for it. So for me, I was trained as a silversmith and a jeweler. My first degree is in design. So I'm very good at hitting things with hammers. Isn't that useful in the modern world? But it meant that I could build sets and I could build, because I trained as an animator,
physical
I
sets,
could right? build things move together. Sorry?
Building physical sets? Or
virtual sets. Actually, no, they were physical sets, but they were models. So my very first job in the film industry was in LA working the company that invented blue screen, actually, Van der Veer.
Wow.
I worked for a sub company that worked with Van der Veer a lot, built physical models that they then shot. So it had very forced perspectives.
Yeah.
And they were made out of fiberglass, which is just a horrible thing to work with.
Yes.
It's just carcinogenic and it can give you like an emphysema sort of thing. It can make you blind. It's horrendous.
Ugh.
But you can make beautiful detailed models. So things like, let me think about an example that everyone would know. So the Death Star is a fiberglass model.
Wow.
It's a cool. Looks amazing. But there was a geek covered in paint and little bits of fiberglass.
Yeah.
And I decided that really wasn't for me. But I spent a year or so just moving sand around, making sure everything fitted well. And it was a lovely introduction to it. It's also just completely gone now. All of that is done in 3D. Just gone.
The old, we'll fix it in post.
Yes.
Favorite words. Yep.
Yes.
And then you then transitioned into visual effects, and it wasn't your uncle in the studio. It wasn't one of those nepo baby things.
Oh, if only, no. Nothing to do with film. I do remember very clearly standing there coated in gunge from a day at the studio and seeing people leaving that looked really clean but did look like creatives. I'm like, what did they do?
What
did
they
work with computers?
Yeah.
I want to do that. They go, because I realized. It's a horrible thing. I realized that I would go home and shower, obviously, because I was filthy. I realized that I was wearing out the shower at home from the fiberglass stuff that was rinsing off me. I was wearing, it's just vile.
Ew, so sounds like you can work here or you can work at Chernobyl. You decide. So.
Yes, it wasn't good. There weren't a lot of old effects people at that point.
Yeah.
So that was physical effects, SFX. And I moved into the more traditional visual effects. I have a master's in it, actually.
Wow. I came back and trained. Oh, yes. That's cool. And now today I have a master's in Zoom, which means absolutely nothing.
Yeah. Oh, it was good. And from there, I started working. I came back to the UK and I worked up through ad agencies and working on lots of commercials. which, as working on TV and commercials, you actually get a lot more experience as the turnover is much quicker.
Yeah. And you got to do everything on any given day. My favorite, like, I didn't think that this was in the job description. When I worked at a radio station in Boston and I was the promotion manager, you do a little of everything. And we had to go and do a parade. And one of the parade sponsors was like a pickle company. And they're like, oh my God, Captain Pickle didn't show up, the guy in the pickle costume. And they're like, promotion guy, get in the pickle costume.
Wow, you are my pickle.
So I was Captain Pickle that day. And the only problem was that I was behind the big remote unit spewing out exhaust the whole time. By the end of the day, it was a very top-heavy costume. Captain Pickle was looking like he had a little too much pickle juice because...
I can imagine. Yeah, no, I remember when I was working on an ad in London and they needed a voiceover. I can't remember what it was. It was some dreadful thing. Needed a female voice and the female voiceover just didn't turn up fine. So I'm sitting there in the edit with them, just out of politeness, really.
Yeah.
And they said, so we need somebody with a soft northern accent. I'm like, righto. And eventually I realized that the six of them, including the editor, were all going, oh, me?
Yeah.
Well, done my voiceover time. And the annoying thing about it was they were annoyed that I wasn't a very good voiceover artist.
Yeah, it's not what I do.
Exactly. Well, if you'd like
I hope you got scale or union or whatever.
No, they bought me a bar of chocolate.
Oh, nice. Okay. It's almost as good. So how does any of all this stuff, crazy stuff that we've done, transfer to the online digital crazy world that we're in today? Is there any connection at all?
I really think there is. So first of all, there's the fact that film directors, the people I worked with most of the time, are incredibly directed. They're very talented. They have a million things on their mind at any one time. They're trying to do too much. They've always got a project that is in development. The yep. thing they are currently shooting, and in my case, the thing that they are helping me post.
Yeah.
So they've already got three things they're juggling, all of this stuff on their mind. And that can make them a little scattered, a little difficult to focus. That is very similar to working with entrepreneurs because I'm a business coach now, a strategist, and I help people get really clear on their ideas, what to do next.
Yeah.
And that feeling of this is how film directors are. Once I started working with entrepreneurs, I'm like...
Yeah, that's the so the director might have a film in post-production, he might have a film in pre-production, he might be on a set right now, and that's, yeah, I have a few different promotions I'm doing right now.
Of course you do.
So, yeah, so I'm an auteur, I'm a director now.
Auteur, exactly. Yeah. So that big creative vision and not entirely sure how to get there, that's really similar. And the other thing that really surprised me is in film, we are all expecting things to go horribly wrong any moment. If you're on, I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but if you're ever on a set where nothing has gone wrong, right. Everybody is so jumpy because we know it's going to be hideous. So the thing's going to burst into flames or the lead is going to drop dead. Stuff just goes horribly wrong and you deal with it. So once I started working with entrepreneurs, I found it really actually shocking to begin with that people didn't expect the worst to happen.
Yes.
So be still up like, what? And it's why you and I are good problem solvers, because you're like, oh, okay, so it has burst into flames. Okay.
Yeah,
so this is what we're going to do. This is the secondary plan. I think nothing goes, like running a business is going to bring up everything that you have ever wondered about in yourself, in your business. It's going to scare your bank account occasionally. It's going to give it weird surges of good stuff and then like nothing for a while.
Yeah.
And from my film experience, I felt this is what I expected. But clients were like, and then? And I'm like, yes. And what was your plan when this terrible thing happened? I didn't have one.
No, not that. There's no plan B. So
exactly.
It's interesting because bringing it back to the Godfather thing, I saw an interview with Al Ruddy, who's now like 92, who's a producer of The Godfather. And he said, and I think this is very true, that a chaotic movie set where everything goes wrong oftentimes leads to a film masterpiece. So maybe, I mean, hoping that's the same with online world, because everything that can go wrong will go wrong. But in
completely.
The end, hopefully you'll have a better product for it.
Sorry, my mistake. I was just checking that I didn't have another call, top of the hour.
Oh, yeah,
sorry.
No worries.
So it's absolutely fine. Sorry. I hope I didn't cut across you there. But I just had that kind of, look, it's the summer in a room.
I know. I had a call, but I bowed out of it.
So one of the things I would love to talk to you about is having to apply for your own Oscar awards. People do not know this about the Oscars, or indeed any of those awards. It doesn't just happen. A benevolent industry doesn't just anoint someone.
Yeah.
You have to put in your own damn forms.
Wow.
And I've seen people get really aerated when they learn this information. What do you mean?
You mean it's not just some altruistic, like, of course Tom Cruise is going to get nominated because he's Tom Cruise. No, he has a team. And I'm sure Tom doesn't fill out the application.
Oh, no, I'm sure not. No, and these days, often you have a whole department of a film studio. That's all they do. And they then hire an agency that pitches for all of that. In the 90s, when I was in L.A., you could go around to the directors' houses. Like, obviously, these things have changed with the world. Yeah. But, and members of the Academy, that's the other thing. Members of the Academy, there's only about 200 people, but it's only the film directors that vote on the film director, the actors that vote. So it can be about 50 people who are making this decision. So you put yourself forwards, you pay the small fee to do that, and then those 50 people vote on it. Now, is it any less fabulous because you put your hand up and went, I think my work's rather good. I think you should choose it. No, of course not. But somehow that mystique of somehow the Oscars has managed to hide this from people.
Yeah. No, it's business. And it's funny because the same thing, like when I first went to Los Angeles and I saw these full page ads in Variety
for your consideration.
So basically there's a whole media campaign trying to influence those few people who vote and with full page ads. And it's just, it's a business proposition and crazy.
Absolutely. And they have very strict rules about you. You can't send gifts. You can't send money. You can't bribe people. Have someone over to a party, but a party can't be specifically for, we're going to get Lou an Oscar. It can't be that. It can be, there's 200 people here and Lou's up for an Oscar. What do you know?
Let's get the social media blitz going. And it's so funny that people don't realize. The other thing that's similar to that a little bit, but not quite as glamorous, is you don't just get a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. You apply for it and you pay for it dearly. Now, I don't know if I could pay enough to get on. That's the whole thing. Oh my gosh, so-and-so got their star. I'm like, so they coughed up the $75,000 and did the PR.
Exactly. And it's social proof. But it's also, it's an industry allowing you to step forward. And I think that's important because, I don't know, just if you just slave away or you're working in the trench of your own industry, it's nice if someone says, you did well.
Yeah.
Here's a thing that you did well. That's lovely. Even if you had to apply for it yourself, there's still a nice thing.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the same thing. It's like we did award shows. It was big money. It was like when I worked at a trade association, the awards show was the biggest revenue generator because of the entry fees. So
yes, I know that in the design awards for ad agencies can easily be $500 a seat, and the big agencies will buy two or three tables like that.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of money. Yeah, I used to, as a geek, they would never let me go to the award show like that. And in fact, actually, I have friends who have won Oscars, like technical Oscars.
Yeah.
They have that on a completely different day.
That's not very nice. I know.
No, it isn't.
Yeah.
I have
this weekend earlier at the Denny's, we awarded the
exactly round the back.
Right. So, and I don't know if you know this, I actually went to the Oscars one year.
Oh, did you? What was it like?
Because I was not supposed to be there, obviously. But one of my friends in LA was a member of the Academy. And even back then, and this is 20 years ago, the tickets were like $400 a pop, not for the nominees. Okay, I have to pay to go to the Oscars and I have to pay for a limo and the whole thing. But I'm like, okay, bucket list. I went, she gave me the tickets. Back then it was like, I'll just give you my Oscar tickets and you can go to the Oscars. Now to get it, you have got to be like vetted by the Secret Service. And
so imagine my friend Dori Clark, don't you? You must know. So Dori was up for a Grammy. You know this about her? She is a woman of incredible talent. One of the things she just casually mentioned to me one day was that tomorrow I fly to the Grammys. I wrote about a year ago, she said, I wrote this off-Broadway thing that is now, Dori is a business coach, strategist, and she's an exec coach. She does everything. She does unbelievably well. So she's up for a Grammy. Really? And she said, I'm unlikely to win, but I'm going.
Yeah.
And what she told me, that absolutely flabbergasted, this is years ago, is that the red carpet, as we know, it's only for the important people. Also, but that also isn't everyone that is up for an award. So big stuff, the lovely Beyoncés and the well-known people, they get to walk the carpet. But the sort of the riffraff.
That's what happened to me at the Oscars.
They do let them in the front door, but they make them go about 5 hours before everyone else. You've got to be in at your seat at 2 or 3 p.m. And then, of course, the actual awards aren't until 7:30, 8. The food doesn't start till 6:30. Yeah. So you've got 3 hours.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to mess yourself up, put it anyway, dribble your food down you. So you have to sit there quietly. So she took a sandwich. And I was like, no, I have never been as invested in any sandwich ever. What do you take to the Emmys? Is that an egg sandwich? Is that a cheese sandwich? What do you take? So she was live texting the sandwich to me.
Oh, my God.
Very happy.
I have managed to smuggle the peanut butter sandwich past the gauntlet of security.
Exactly. Oh. So she ate that. And then you just have to sit in your seat applauding all the big names. And of course, they don't get to her small off-Broadway stuff till about midnight. Half the people have left at that point. So she's been there for at least 9 hours before that. Not televised. Nothing happened yet. So nowhere near as glamorous as you'd expect.
The magic of Hollywood. Before we wrap up, tell folks what you are doing now and how they can find you and or work with you.
Thank you very much. So I'm a business strategist. If you check out rethinkcentral.com, you'll see my mastermind stuff. But come and say hello at my Instagram, which is also Rethink Central. I would love to say hello to people.
Rethink Central. And Evil Coach, tell folks about Evil Coach.
Oh, yeah. So Evil Coach is my strategy website. It's ridiculous. It is strategy, planning, growing your business, seen through the lens of BDSM, sex, kink. Because BDSM isn't understood, and frankly, strategy isn't understood. And there is nothing salacious about it. It is purely a ridiculous way to giggle and learn at the same time. It's great.
Well, that's cool because you're making it fun and lighthearted, and it doesn't have to be that serious.
Exactly.
I'm at the Oscars.
Exactly. It's not an egg sandwich at the Grammys.
This has been so much fun chatting with you and catching up about the Hollywood back in the day. So thank you so much for being on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Take the Cannoli, the Godfather podcast with Lou Bortone. Join us again next time. You know what's good for you. The beige.